Like Lars Porsena in Macaulay's Lays of Ancient Rome, who by the nine gods swore, Patrick Henry swore that he would never countenance the ratification of the Constitution in Virginia. Henry was unenthused about the calling of the Philadelphia Convention in the first place. He was not any more enthused when he saw what it produced. I have to lament that I cannot bring my mind to accord with the proposed Constitution, he told George Washington, who had personally appealed to Henry on September 24th to swing his considerable influence and talents behind it. Henry protested that he had only the highest reverence for Washington's opinion, but the concern I feel on this account is really greater than I am able to express. That concern meant that Henry would mobilize every political resource and employ every political strategy at his command to stop the new Constitution in its tracks. That gentleman has descended to lower artifice and management upon the occasion than I thought him capable of, warned one of Madison's informants. Scaring the political willies out of people with prophecies that adopting the Constitution would mean the surrender of the Mississippi River to the Spaniards, and the establishment of a national church, which would stamp out the toleration Henry had championed for the Protestant evangelical awakeners in the backcountry. If Virginia's consent was necessary in order to make the overall ratification process work, then neutralizing Patrick Henry would be the most important task the Federalists would have in America. And, as Madison learned, Henry was already working up every possible interest into a spirit of opposition. Back at the very beginning of this series, I said that the Constitution has enjoyed an almost mystical reverence in American life. For that reason, it may be difficult to understand that it would have been greeted with anything less than automatic approval, even adulation, by Americans in 1787. Well, in some places it was, but in other places it was not. And no matter how solid and unmoving the Constitution now seems on our horizons, it was never going to get above those horizons in the first place unless the states, through a series of ratifying conventions, endorsed it. And that meant persuading, convincing, appeasing, overawing, underdealing, and in general, outmaneuvering what Gouverneur Morris denounced as the state officers and those interested in the state governments who will intrigue and turn the popular current against it. Intrigue, of course, is a partisan word. We should not discount as easily as Morris did the motives of people like Patrick Henry, or for that matter, George Mason, Sentinel, the Federal Farmer, Mercy Otis Warren, and other skeptics. Or imagine that they were motivated simply by bad temper or poor understanding. Americans like Henry and Mason had fought a long odds, all-in, high-stakes battle against the greatest empire in the Atlantic world for the sake of governing themselves, in their own places, in their own way. They were not easily going to be persuaded that they should now embrace what looked to them like the reimposition of the imperial rule they had thrown off. Nor were the motives of the Federalists entirely free from self-interest. It was a matter of principle to complain about the arrogance of pin-headed legislatures who imagined that they could redistribute debt and property with a wave of their hands and to their own benefit. But it might not be quite so noble when it turned out that establishing good credit and restraining the states from printing funny money also had some very direct personal benefits for the Constitution's friends. Rarely in a democracy will high purpose march unattended by self-aggrandizement. In fact, the latter might turn out to be the former's best friend. It is also rare in a democracy that high purpose wins its place just by showing up. High purpose has to win votes, too, and so did the Constitution. There were, however, three elements which were working in the Constitution's favor as it prepared to make its long and dangerous passage of the state ratifying conventions. First of all, working in its favor was prestige. It was the product of a long convention involving some of the most respected figures in American life, starting with Washington and Franklin, and their prestige would pay handsome dividends in swaying opinion. "It is probable General Washington will be the first president of the United States," reasoned Alexander Hamilton at the close of the convention. "That will ensure a wise choice of men to administer the government. And in turn, a good administration will conciliate the confidence and affection of the people." A second factor working in the Constitution's favor was surprise. The convention had kept its secrets amazingly well, which meant that its critics had to scramble hastily to absorb the Constitution and then generate enough criticisms to slow it to a halt. Third factor working in the Constitution's favor was organization. The Constitution emerged from the convention with a solid cadre of supporters who could provide the intellectual firepower to engage, if not actually overwhelm, the objections raised by Elbridge Gerry, George Mason, Edmund Randolph, and now Patrick Henry. There was also a fourth element working in the Constitution's favor, and that was momentum. Benjamin Franklin and the Pennsylvania delegation to the convention moved at once to lay the Constitution before the Pennsylvania Assembly and ask for the calling of a state convention. And they didn't have to go far to do this. The Pennsylvania Assembly was meeting on the second floor of the State House. So Thomas Fitzsimmons, in Franklin's behalf, only had to climb the stairs on September 17th to ask for leave to introduce the Constitution to the Pennsylvania Assembly. And the next morning, it was read publicly in the presence of a large crowd of citizens who stood in the gallery of the Assembly Room and who testified the highest pleasure in seeing that great work at last perfected. Franklin, in his role as president of the Assembly, wanted quick action, largely because he also wanted Pennsylvania to be the first to offer the 10-mile square district, which would become the national capital. He would not get his wish, though, because the Assembly was scheduled to take an adjournment from September 29th till October 9th for elections. And not even Benjamin Franklin could ask for the calling of a ratifying convention until word had been received from New York City that Congress was actually sending the Constitution to the states. When that word finally arrived on September 28th, George Clymer, one of the Pennsylvania delegation to the convention, moved to call a state ratifying convention which would hold elections on the first Tuesday in November and meet on the last day of November. That slight delay gave the Delaware legislature the chance to jump ahead and call a ratifying convention with elections to be held on November 9th and 10th. When the Delaware Convention met in Dover on December 4th, the 30 members of the convention had but one thing in mind: that the new Constitution would unshackle the tiny state from paying tariffs to Pennsylvania for goods shipped through the Port of Philadelphia. The move to ratify on December 7th was swift, unanimous, and, as the state's nickname has ever since reminded us, first among all the states to ratify. In short order, Connecticut and Massachusetts called their town meetings to choose delegates to a state convention to meet in November and in January. New Jersey called a convention which met in Trenton and ratified the Constitution on December 18th, followed by Georgia, whose convention was called on October 26th and met in Augusta for all of 2 days before voting to ratify. But from that point, the momentum began to slow. The Pennsylvania ratifying convention met in Philadelphia on November 20th, But the members showed no sense of urgency in their deliberations and consumed 4 days on procedural matters and adjournments before finally getting down to business. Just as he had done in October, James Wilson, the only member of the Constitutional Convention to serve in the Pennsylvania ratifying convention, leapt forward with a lengthy speech in support of ratification and supporting the call of Thomas McCain, the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, for a single up or down vote on the whole Constitution. Taking his cue from Hamilton's and Madison's Federalist Papers, Wilson insisted that the new Constitution was a genuinely federal document, which struck the middle of the road note between a disconnected shambles and a centralized despotism. The Constitution would admit all the advantages and exclude all the disadvantages which are incidental to the known and established constitutions of government. But Wilson was just as promptly brushed back by a vicious attack by John Smiley, a small farmer of a fretful and unquiet temper from Fayette County, who demanded that the convention begin to alter or amend the Constitution piece by piece. And so the Pennsylvania Convention commenced plowing doggedly through each article, including the preamble. Again, the absence of a Bill of Rights was cited as a radical wrong. Again, the nightmare of a consolidated government was conjured up. On November 26th, Wilson and McCain won a test vote, which prevented the convention from going into a committee of the whole and delaying the ratification for who knows how long. And on December 12th, they finally managed to force a vote on ratification and won, 44-24. The bells in Christ Church in Philadelphia were rung to celebrate, but the dissenting delegates were so unreconciled to the ratification that they refused to sign the ratification resolution. The Pennsylvania ratification was not a good sign, apart from the single fact that it added a fourth state to the required 9 ratifying states. The Connecticut Convention, which had been called in mid-October, did not assemble in Hartford until January 3rd. And several of the Connecticut town meetings instructed their delegates to bring up proposed amendments. Once assembled, the convention then proceeded, like the Pennsylvania Convention, to move tediously through a review of each article. And not until January 9th did the Connecticut Convention finally vote to ratify 128-40. That made 5 states. But the issue was clearly losing its initial headway. New Hampshire's legislature was not scheduled to meet until January of 1788. So John Sullivan, the state president, called a special session of the legislature for December 14th. A ratifying convention was duly authorized, but it would not meet until February 13th. And then, after 9 days, it voted not to ratify, but to adjourn. The conduct of New Hampshire respecting the proposed government was a matter of general surprise, wrote a baffled Washington to a member of the short-lived convention. Her local situation, unconnected with other circumstances, was supposed to be a sufficient inducement to adopt a general government. In New York, the unsympathetic governor, George Clinton, felt none of Sullivan's urgency about calling for a special session of the state legislature. He waited until the legislature convened in its regular session in January 1788. The New York legislature was just as unagitated. They scheduled the ratifying convention for June. Maryland ignored Federalist demands for a ratifying convention until November, and even when it authorized the convention, did not schedule its meeting date until April. The South Carolina legislature did not take up the Constitution until January, and even then, held its own debate on the Constitution before finally authorizing a state convention on January 19th, a convention which would not elect its members until April and would not convene until May 12th. More might have been hoped for from Massachusetts, which issued a call for a convention in late October when the legislature met. But the lower house of the legislature refused to schedule a ratifying convention's first meeting in Boston until January 9th. And even then, the delegates arrived with instructions from their town meetings to demand a variety of amendments, including a Bill of Rights and religious tests for federal officeholders. A few of the delegates from the western counties of Massachusetts had even been part of Daniel Shea's little army, and they had no interest in approving a federal constitution whose provisions so obviously were intended to suppress any more Shays. The president of the Massachusetts Convention was the old revolutionary, John Hancock, who refused to declare himself for or against ratification. Another old revolutionary, Samuel Adams, was chosen as a delegate from Boston, and he had no hesitation in expressing himself as absolutely against the Constitution. He stopped reading it after the first three words of the preamble, "We the people." "I confess," he told Richard Henry Lee, "as I enter the building, I stumble at the threshold. I meet with a national government instead of a federal union of sovereign states." Beginning on January 14th, the Massachusetts Ratifying Convention proceeded to pick its way through the Constitution, paragraph by paragraph. This went on until January 23rd, when a Federalist delegate, Samuel Nason, moved to consider the Constitution as a whole. But Samuel Adams led a charge which defeated the motion. "We ought not to be stingy of our time," Adams reasoned, in the classic pattern of a delaying action. "That cursed spirit of insurgency that prevailed last year dragged the debates out until February 6th. The final vote in the Massachusetts Convention to ratify was an uneasy 187 to 168. With 9 absences. The Constitution's decaying momentum set an unhappy stage for what everyone understood would be the ultimate test of the Constitution in Virginia. 6 of Virginia's 9 newspapers published the text of the Constitution between the signing in September and the end of November. Nevertheless, the Virginia General Assembly, meeting in October, would not set elections to a ratifying convention until March, nor the meeting of the convention until June. It was clear to George Washington why. Virginians were divided between those who wanted the Constitution as it was, those who were prepared to concede the necessity of amendments, and those like Patrick Henry who refused any part of a Constitution. The amenders especially wanted to see which way the wind was blowing before committing themselves. The legislature of this state appointed the convention on the first Monday in June in order to see if those states whose conventions are to meet sooner should adopt the plan. If, he added, some of them should reject it, it is very probable that the opposers of it here will exert themselves to add this state to the number. The long prelude to the Virginia Ratifying Convention was a gift to Virginia's anti-Federalists, Richard Henry Lee, George Mason, and of course, Patrick Henry. As Madison put it, they together would create difficulties. And they were joined by Virginians from whom Madison had hoped for more cooperation, former Governor Benjamin Harrison, his own cousin, Reverend James Madison, the president of William and Mary, and James Monroe. Richard Henry Lee took the lead as a writer, publishing a 64-page pamphlet of extracts from the Constitution, along with vitriolic attacks on them. Edmund Randolph published another. But it was Patrick Henry, who orchestrated, with his usual address, every possible interest into a spirit of opposition, shrewdly frightening Virginians who had unpaid pre-war debts to British merchants, or who had occupied confiscated Tory properties, with the specter of being dragged into faraway federal courts for a shaking down. No speech of Henry's in the Assembly, no matter what the topic, ended without some swipe at the Constitution. Mr. Henry has, upon all occasions, wrote one of Madison's informants in the Assembly, however foreign his subject, attempted to give the Constitution a side blow. Elections to the ratifying convention became fiercely competitive. And in March, Madison, who had been urged by Washington to stand for election to the convention, had to break off his collaboration with Hamilton in producing the Federalist in New York and come back to Virginia to stave off a challenge from an anti-Federalist convert, Thomas Barber, in Orange County. Madison won, easily, 202 votes to 56. But the real test of things would come in the ratifying convention itself, which assembled on June 2, 1788, in Richmond. A great proportion, wrote one scandalized Federalist delegate, of the anti-Federalists are clamorous in their opposition out of doors, ready to pursue any desperate step countenanced by their party. But they would be even more formidable indoors with Patrick Henry as their figurehead. The convention was gaveled to order by Edmund Pendleton, after George Wythe, the greatest of Virginia's lawyers and judges, and on a motion from George Mason, they agreed to begin a full discussion, clause by clause, as the most proper mode of proceeding. But the convention was not really weighing the clauses. It was waiting for Patrick Henry. And on June 4th, he did not disappoint them. "I conceive the Republic to be in extreme danger," he announced solemnly. "This anxiety arises from a proposal to change our government, a proposal that goes to the utter annihilation of the most solemn engagements of the states." The evidence of this was to be found at the very beginning of the Constitution, as it had been for Sam Adams, in the first three words, "We the people." Who authorized them to speak the language of "we the people" instead of "we the states"? Asked Henry. "States are the characteristics and the soul of a confederation. If the states be not the agents of this compact, it must be one great consolidated national government." George Mason, dressed in a full suit of black, was quick to follow Henry's line of attack. "Whether the Constitution be good or bad," Mason claimed, "is irrelevant. The power to levy tariffs without the by your leave of the individual states clearly discovers that it is a national government and no longer a confederation." But returning to the theme of too much bigness, Mason asked whether a national government could supervise a nation as big as the United States without becoming tyrannical by necessity. Was there ever an instance of a general national government extending over so extensive a country, abounding in such a variety of climates, etc., where the people retained their liberty? "Considering the natural lust of power so inherent in man," said Mason, "I fear the thirst of power will prevail to oppress the people." Still, for all the rhetorical fireworks, Henry and Mason were not going to be allowed to hijack the convention if Madison could help it. Speaking briefly at the end of the June 4th session, Madison paved the way for Henry Lee, the famed Light Horse Harry Lee, to go on the attack. Why, Lee asked, why was Patrick Henry resorting to such scare tactics? Was it proper to appeal to the fear of this House rather than its judgment? And who was Henry really afraid of? The expression, "we the people," had not been foisted on the Constitutional Convention by cunning schemers. In fact, what could be more proper than to begin a Constitution by appealing to the people whose sovereignty it embodied? "Ought we not to make use of the name of the people?" asked Lee. No other style would be proper. It was the people who were demanding change based on the imbecility of the Confederation to that defective system which never can make us happy at home. But it would fall to Madison on June 6th to deliver not fireworks, but a calm, resolute dissection of Henry's alarm. Was Patrick Henry fearful for a loss of liberty? Upon a review of history, Madison coolly replied, he would have found that the loss of liberty very often resulted from factions and divisions, from local considerations, which eternally lead to quarrels. He would have found internal dissensions to have more frequently demolished civil liberty than consolidated government. The truth is, Madison continued, that the new Constitution has created a middle ground between a disconnected heap of states and a single concentrated government. Notwithstanding what the honorable gentleman has alleged, said Madison, this government is not completely consolidated, nor is it entirely federal. Who are the parties to it? The people. But not the people as composing one great body, but the people as composing 13 sovereignties. Should all the states adopt it, it will be then a government established by the 13 states of America, not through the intervention of the legislatures, but by the people at large. In this particular respect, the distinction between the existing and proposed government is very material and will be found to exclude the evils of absolute consolidation as well as of a mere confederacy. For 9 days, the arguments swayed back and forth, including a powerful speech by Patrick Henry on June 24th, punctuated by a violent thunderstorm that drowned out even Patrick Henry's rolling voice, as if beings of a higher order were demanding to be heard. Affairs in the convention are suspended by a hair, wrote William Grayson. I really cannot tell you on which side the scale will turn. On June 25th, after 3 weeks of wrangling, the question was called for, and on a roll call vote demanded by George Mason, ratification won, 89-79. But the Federalists had not won their victory without conditions. The ratifying resolutions required that any imperfections in the Constitution be remedied by amendments, which would guarantee that no right of any religious denomination can be canceled, abridged, restrained, or modified by the Congress, by the Senate, or House of Representatives, acting in any capacity, by the President, or any department or officer of the United States. And among other essential rights, liberty of conscience and of the press cannot be canceled, abridged, restrained, or modified by any authority of the United States. In shorter terms, Madison and his fellow Federalists had obtained the most important of the state ratifications, but only at the price of pledging themselves to add a Bill of Rights. And the irony of that concession was that, technically speaking, it need not have been made. Tardily, the Maryland and South Carolina ratifying conventions had ratified the Constitution on April 28th and May 23rd. New Hampshire's convention, whose adjournment had so depressed Washington, reassembled on June 18th and voted to ratify on June 21st, making it the 9th state to ratify, and thus giving the Constitution legal standing even while the Virginia delegates were still voting. New York, its anti-Federalists, felled by the news of Virginia's ratification, would narrowly follow suit on July 26th. The Constitution had arrived at last.